This is Unpaved episode 3, where we're going to be looking at the extremes. We're looking at the extremes of off-road bike racing or endurance style bike packing. And we're going to be chatting to the Racing Collective, who are the people behind GB Duro, which is an ultra endurance challenge from Land's End John O'Groats that was run for the first time last year in 2019. So we're going to be chatting to Miles Rezzo and Philippa Batty from the Racing Collective, and also Tom Probert, who raced GB Duro among about 7 other endurance events last year. So we're going to be talking a bit about what it takes to put on a route like that.
And we're going to do this podcast slightly differently because this was our overnighter. So we spent not only a really nice Friday night and a chilly bivvy with our guests, but we also did a ride the next day and spoke to Lachlan Morton from RAFA EF,
who absolutely crushed GB Duro, and he was the first person to finish.
I think I just found something in that event particularly that I hadn't had in any other form of competitive riding. I also feel like I only kind of figured it out towards the end of it, what it's all really about.
And he's interesting because he's a professional road racer in his day job, but he's now doing this alternative calendar of off-road events. And last year he did the Three Peak Challenge in Yorkshire, as well as GB Duro, Dirty Kanza, and his attitude towards them is really, really interesting. So there's quite a lot. So we're going to split this episode into two parts, and we'll tell you a little bit more about that at the end.
Yeah, there was just so much wisdom and really good, funny stories, so we didn't want to have to cut anything out.
So we'll just play you a little bit of our journey up into the woods.
Could you introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Miles Rezzo, founder of the Racing Collective.
I'm Philippa Batty, and...
Sabotage.
How organised you?
I'm Philippa Batty. I like riding bikes a long way, and I co-organise GB Duro.
Tom Probert, bike rider and graphic designer for the Racing Collective.
Did you get that in the background? Woo! When was the last time you camped out?
Summer.
Oh, come on.
In August.
Yeah, Tom?
Yeah, Pyrenees, somewhere in the Pyrenees, in the summer, last summer.
So I love how we came under the pretense that you guys do this all year round.
Yeah.
Nah, you do.
Yeah,
starting from now.
Yes, yeah. No better time to start than January.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right.
Yeah, it was definitely warmer last
time. Tell me about what you remember from that ride up there.
There was a lot of nervous anticipation. It had been wonderful being in this like warm, cosy pub on a Friday night, absolutely bustling. And then we're sort of heading out into the darkness. You could see the roads almost twinkling a little bit as we headed up the hill. And then Tom had the logs on his back in this like weird old military, I don't know how you describe it, big rucksack thing, and it was absolutely hilarious. And then
it's a bit like the knapsack that Puss in Boots has on a stick, but with a shoulder strap.
Yeah, it was really funny. And then Miles was showing us the way, and you know when it just like descends into bog, and you're like, does this guy actually know where he's going?
You know where we are.
There's two ways up to it. We've got the height now. Oh no, actually, there's still a hill.
We were going to ride to our campsite on the road, and then we took a wrong turn and ended up on late night, black, drunken gravel. And we've just arrived at a fence / gate where we have to just climb over it into a muddy field. Looks really waterlogged and muddy. Who knows what's on the other side?
There was definitely just the whole feeling of like just being a bit giddy from being out in the middle of the night when it felt a bit naughty.
We can go left along a good track and then an unknown, or a good track and then a fence and then some mud and then a fence and then mud.
The unknown can't be worse than fence, mud, fence, mud.
It might be a long bit of mud. Let's try it.
Logman, give me your log. No.
I'm taking the logs.
I remember just getting up to the top of this plateau and I could see that like it was going to be really good for a fire and I was like, this is going to be great.
We sort of came upon this clearing and started to set up our fire, and it was beautiful actually. It was such a clear night. I guess that was part of what made it so cold.
I think that's a good one. That's getting a lot of heat, that one. It's going to take a long time to dry out, but that's got a lot of heat.
I sat down with Miles, the founder of the Racing Collective, to chat about how it all started. So, what was the gap that made you think that the Racing Collective needed to come about, and what made you really think about founding it as a principle?
It was mainly about the TCR, actually, so the Transcontinental. Once I'd committed to that, so that was late 2016, I thought, right, well, how the heck am I going to train for this thing? Okay, I'll simulate a mini TCR, I'll set up a schedule, and I'll simulate what the TCR does. So 4 checkpoints, ride from point to point. And I thought, well, if I'm going to go through it, why not tell other people that this thing's happening? So, yeah, it started off with a series, Trans England, Trans Wales, Trans Scotland. And, yeah, the first one, Trans England, I'd turn up at Morecambe Bay at 11 p.m. Friday night, and no one's there. Just me.
Just you.
I count down the clock, and off I go. And I just, you know, just rode it. And it was absolutely brilliant, because you're riding off into the night, and it's basically perfect training for the TCR, because you're going to have to ride at night. It's all about intrinsic motivation, so the fact that like no one's there watching you is a really important aspect. So it's all about kind of not going too far, but pushing your limits. Mm. And the idea is to explore the best that the British Isles has got to offer.
So last year you launched GB Giro for the first time. What even is it?
So it's a 2000K, well, we call it a scrappy rolling picnic. So it's relatively easy. It's broken down into 4 stages. So the first stage is 630K from Land's End to Mid Wales, and then it goes from there. And the idea was that through having the checkpoints and the time stops at the checkpoints, riders get a chance to sit around and discuss things. And some of the most enjoyable bits are at the checkpoints, where you're interacting with other riders, and you know, out of the billions of people on the planet, there are obviously people that where you share a heck of a lot in common. On GB Giro, I like to think that the kind of the format lends itself to really like deep and meaningful chats. I mean, I'm hoping that through these kind of exhaustive exercises, so you know, racing to checkpoint one or whatever, I'm hoping that it kind of unlocks a bit of imagination in people. And so the real end game with something like GB Giro is to try and capture some of that when people get to a checkpoint and kind of unload what they've just been through. Mm. It really brings out, without turning too corny, it's what it means to be human. And a lot of the modern day world is, you know, we get so far away from the basic kind of human ways of being, you know, eating, sleeping, in this case, being on your bike. But by, you know, through that exertion, through exercise, you kind of strip it back to its raw essence. Mm. And hopefully there's something to be gained through that.
You could look at it as something new that's kind of sprung out of this want for adventure, you know, this sort of like post-road racing scene.
So this is Lachlan, and we chatted to him one night over WhatsApp because he's in Australia.
People want something else outside of, you know, going to a road race and pumping your tyres up, pinning a number on and getting aggro for a few hours. Like, it's grown out of that, but if you look at the history of cycling on the whole, it's actually kind of how it all started. The idea of being unsupported, covering really big distances. A lot of that is, like, if you look at the origins of road racing, that's sort of where it all began. So it's almost full circle in a way.
I'd actually ridden to Checkpoint 1 on GB Giro because I'd been in Wales that weekend at Gritfest, and we were quite close by, so we were like, oh, might as well carry on touring and go there. Hopefully, like, see Lockie in the flesh, which is pretty cool as a pro rider. And of course, being Wales, there wasn't any signal, so we couldn't check out where people were. We couldn't look at the docks on the screen. You just had to sort of blindly go there and hope that you'd be there in time. And then when we did actually turn up, Lockie'd already been and gone. So we went into the barn and we found Angus Young and Fraser Hughes, who were right at the head of the race. And they were explaining this, and that he'd come in the day before, had something to eat, had a shower, slept, and then got up early in the morning and just cracked on, which was just unthinkable almost. And as the time stops when you're at these checkpoints, like, you can spend as long as you like. So they were going to wait a lot longer and wait for everybody else to come in and hang out. But I think he was under time pressure as he had a flight at the other end, which is just mad to get your head around.
It's like the most incredible mixed terrain route for the length of the UK. And I'm blown away by the course itself, because, like, I know, like, personally, I spend like years perfecting my own routes just in my backyard, and still I think I struggle to rival any sections of that course. It's also like, it's probably, if you looked at that course, like, it's the most efficient way to cover it is on a bike. You know, like, you would struggle to drive it. You couldn't do a lot of it on a motorbike. You know, it's like you're covering it in probably the most efficient way. And it's almost like you have company in the way that the route's so well thought out, because you can kind of see what whoever created that section, you can understand what they were thinking. But it all makes sense. You know, like, there's nothing for the sake of it. Even the hard sections, you kind of rewarded, because you realize at the end of the day, like, there would have been no other way to get to this next section, right?
You're not just going off-road for the heck of it. It is about connecting places, and you're trying to progress through this country. And there's so much good riding that you can kind of take in, but we're not allergic to road, you know? There's no point in just going along a shitty bridleway just for the sake of it. So the idea was to connect the really good bits of gravel. If it's no good, then just hit the road.
The last couple of days in Scotland, once I kind of worked out how to manage myself, like, physically and mentally, so I could really, really enjoy it, you know, without being, like, scared. That was incredible. And just, like, initially, like, the idea of being sort of remote for those long periods is, like, daunting. But the further I got into it, the more I really enjoyed those long, long sections by myself. So, I think, like, those last few days, like, up in Scotland were probably my most, like, fond memories. They were incredibly difficult. Like, just, like, the mental state I was in, the state I was physically, the fact I was sort of trying to take it on overnight. Like, there were a lot of factors there that just made that seem, like, impossibly difficult. I remember very, like, specifically, like, being 120 k's away, I think, from the end, and knowing, like, it was probably like 10 hours or something, and just had absolutely no idea how I was going to get there, you know? Like, just absolutely no idea. Like, it's so impossible. That'll stick with me for sure. It's just a race against yourself, really, you know? Like, as much as, you know, that you're aware there's other people out there sort of competing or riding, like, it's purely about how you manage your own head more than anything. And obviously, like, learning to manage yourself physically is a part of it, but really it's just kind of getting the most out of yourself and, like, going to that dark place and then working out how to deal with that, or, like, how you're going to react to that. It's not one of those things that you do one time and you're like, okay, I've got it, I've worked it out. You know, like, each time something will creep up and you sort of find yourself reacting differently, and it's just sort of managing that. So I guess, like, I was pretty worried about, like, because I'd never really gone to that sort of headspace, like, how I would react, you know? It's quite daunting, and, like, it can be pretty confronting to sort of realize what's in there. But I guess that's what I was worried about. And, like, I hate the idea of quitting something. But I guess, like, a lot of that was, even just in starting it, I kind of had to accept the fact that, like, that's kind of a very real possibility that you don't finish. I didn't have any expectations, so I can't say whether like I was surprised or, you know, I don't know. I just kind of took it as it came. So I think like I realized pretty early on that like any expectation only slows you down, because like that's just ego, and ego doesn't get you very far when it's like, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning and you feel like crying and your headlamp's broken, you know, like, yeah, you sort of got to let those things go a little bit.
I guess what I wanted to ask Lockie was, what is it about this kind of racing that he was starting to fall in love with?
I don't know. I think I just found something in that event particularly that, like, I hadn't had in any other form of competitive riding. So, like, I felt very, like at home, you know, like I feel like I've been looking for something in competitive cycling for a long time, and like to do that event and feel like I'd found it, it's one of those things, if you find something like that that really fulfills you on like a total level, you know, you want to do more of it. So I kind of had that feeling of like, I've sort of been like preparing for this sort of thing my whole life without knowing, and then now found it, you know. So, I think it's like, I also feel like I only kind of figured it out towards the end of it, what it's all really about. So, I wanted to take like what I learned and just apply that to something else as quickly as I could. But, unfortunately I have restrictions with my job, so I can't just do it all the time, but it definitely like opened up a can of worms for me, that's for sure.
So having been doing some of these events, I wanted to ask Lachlan what he thought the pro peloton could learn from them.
I think like it's about community more than anything. I think like it's about like the interaction with like greater cycling, and you know, like what you kind of got to question what your role is as a professional athlete, because it's very easy to go, well, my role is while I'm here to win races, make as much money as I can for 15 years and then, you know, move on with my life. But I mean, the reality is, I think the purpose of professional athletes is to inspire people to get outside, to do things, to be active, and like I think like there's other ways that we could be more effective in doing that. So I don't think that's, I mean, like, as athletes, we're just kind of conditioned by our environment, and, you know, whatever the goalposts are. So it's hard to say, oh, we need to think differently, but I think the sport of, specifically, I think, like, men's road cycling can learn a lot from what's going on in these other events where, you know, they're totally open to anyone. You know, the fans become like competitors, and can be involved by participating, you know, not just by watching. I think like that gives those events so much more meaning, and, you know, the impacts they have on communities and getting people involved with bikes just on the whole, I think it's really exciting to see how these events are changing the sport. I just think we could learn by being involved with that, you know? And it's not about, like, us saying, oh, okay, now we're going to race gravel, but, you know, there's going to be a UCI gravel series where there's 20 teams and you have to be on one of these 20 teams if you want to race, and there's going to be a point structure, you know? And, like, then we're going to have a world championship, and it's not going to be the rainbow jersey, but it's going to be a brown rainbow jersey. Like, it's not about that. It's more like, okay, how can we interact with the people who are actually out there riding bikes? Like, how can we make what we do more relevant.
I think one of the things that the Racing Collective was really keen to promote was the idea of just getting out there and riding on your own doorstep, and sort of the sustainability angle that I think Lachlan has been quite vocal about, especially since the Australian bushfires and the work that he's done to try and raise awareness and funding to help people that have been affected. And I think he's one of the few riders that are actually trying to think about how the sport can progress and what the future looks like in terms of making pro cycling more sustainable.
His spirit kind of embodies what it's all about, really. It's so rare to have someone of his ability to acknowledge that what he's sort of destined to be isn't on the world tour necessarily, and that he's prepared not only, well, most people don't even have the choice, right? To have that ability is exceedingly rare, but then to have the insight to say there's something a little bit broken with it. I think the next step is trying to figure out what a sustainable world tour looks like, and you know, it's not sustainable that riders are just flying around the world picking and choosing which country they're going to visit, and they might, you know, may or may not know much about it. And it's trying to figure out where this goes next, and it will be riders like Lockie who are going to spearhead that movement. And right now the world needs some leaders, not in 10 years time, but it has to start now. So let's see what happens.
I guess if you go back to the first Tour de France, it was very much like the modern transcontinental, where riders were self-supported. They'd probably ride to the start. You know, they don't have a huge entourage of mechanics, soigneurs, etc., all travelling around. Do you think that we're sort of going back to that very early racing? Do you think that's feasible at world tour level?
I'm not going to get this on the podcast, but I'm nodding furiously that yeah, I think the history of the Tour de France is like a little microcosm of kind of human development, if you like, and it was quite sustainable, not through choice, but just that was the way it was. And then it's exploded to thousands of vehicles, and sport has a role to do something alternative, and it's people like Lockie that are going to acknowledge that and not just, you know, start doing offsetting and that sort of stuff, but like change the game. And I really think something like TCR holds the key to that. So I think the future will be about kind of stripping it back to sort of self-supported stuff.
There's things we could do, particularly like with the way like the current model of road cycling looks like. I think there's a lot we could do to try and cut down our impact. I mean, the like cycling and riding a bike should be kind of, I guess, like a pin-up activity for a green mode of transport and exercise, and it has all the parts for that. So I think we could do a better job, especially at a professional elite level, of reflecting that. It's hard to get around the fact that like cycling is elite road cycling is a global. Well, they're global events, so it involves a lot of travel. But I think there's definitely like waste we could cut down on. Yeah, I mean, like, I don't think I'm qualified to say what that looks like, but I would really hope that like we could open that discussion. Yeah.
So having spoken a bit more generally about cycling on the whole, I think next we wanted to find out a bit more about how riding these alternative events like the Dirty Kanzer and the GB Giro, how that had actually affected him personally in his pro career.
It definitely helps me sort of have a better perspective on it, because you kind of realise racing at an elite road level, ultimately you're kind of doing it for yourself, you know? So like, it helps with that, and then I'm like, well, if I don't really, if I'm going to be here doing it, it's just for me, so I might as well be fully, you know, focused and engaged on it, because there's no other reason for me to be here, you know. So yeah, I think it helps in that regard. It helps me have like a broader perspective, and it also like it just keeps me motivated to know that, like, there's a bunch of exciting things going on in our sport. Because it's easy to be sat in a hotel room, like, you know, at a World Tour event, thinking about the next stage or whatever and going, okay, this is what cycling is. You know, I'm at the top of the sport. This is as good as it gets. But, you know, the reality is that's just one very, like, niche experience that only, like, a very small few people have with bikes. The majority of people have a largely different experience. So it's nice to have that sort of in the back of your head.
I think it's fascinating that Lockie said when he's training, it's actually his off-road bike that he's been going to.
I think, like, over the last 4 or 5 years, I've just found myself riding off-road more and more, just in my daily riding, just because I enjoy it more. I find it, like, getting away from traffic is a big one, but it's just sort of engaging, you know? Once you've mastered road riding, you end up pedaling away, like, kind of mindlessly for a long period of time, which is great if you want to think, but it's sort of, it can become, like, pretty monotonous. So I like to sort of mix it up and do, like, mixed terrain, I guess, every time I ride. The only time I really ride on skinny tires is racing on a road bike. So I think, like, it, in that regard, like, I kind of just slowly gravitated towards it. I never really thought I'd compete off-road. It was more so just, you know, my day-to-day riding and what I enjoyed. If I want to think, I'll go on the road. If I want to not think at all, I'll ride off-road. Because I don't have the patience to meditate, but from what I can understand, it's sort of like the idea is just being totally in the moment and clearing your mind. And if you're riding down a trail or, like, a technical bit of dirt, like, you're kind of forced into the moment, right? Because if you stop thinking about what you're doing at that exact moment, you'll crash. So, like, I like it for that, because it forces you to sort of put everything else out of your mind and just be present. So, like, as far as, like, I guess that kind of conditioned me for, like, riding off-road, but I never did any, like, specific, I always train pretty long. I like to ride a lot of hours just because I enjoy being outside, so I sort of try and spend as much time as I can each day out on my bike anyway, which turns out is pretty good training for, like, any sort of events. But it was never, like, a conscious decision. Like, I didn't do anything specific before, like, Kanza or GB Dura. I just kind of jumped into it.
So I guess we tried to get Lockie to spill the beans on what the racing calendar looked like for this year in terms of the alternative calendar. We got a few little hints.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the final calendar looks like. I know 100% I'm going to Cape Epic in March, which I'm really looking forward to. And then I know we're doing Leadville and Kanza again. But beyond that, I'm not 100% sure yet. I'll be fitting in as many as I can. As many as I can get away with, I'll be there. I mean, I'm slowly accumulating a list of races that I really want to do that I think is going to take, like, probably 5 to 10 years to tick off. So, like, I'm not in any rush, but, I'll take on as many as I can this year.
I know if I was in the pro peloton, like, in my wildest dreams, and I was watching all of these amazing videos of Lockie, like, going and smashing GB Dura and having a whale of a time at Dirty Kanza, I'd be really envious. And so I was wondering, why aren't more professional cyclists doing this kind of thing?
It's hard to say. I think, like, It's hard at this level to get people to take the risk, I think. A lot of people see that risk. And I can understand that. You know, a lot of people, especially people coming from outside Europe, like, they've sacrificed a lot to get to that level, and they have a lot riding on them, you know, that's their livelihood. So the idea of going to, you know, a gravel race and falling off and hurting themselves and then, you know, potentially not getting a job, like, that's a very, you know, it's a hard risk to take, which I get that. But I think there's definitely a lot more people sort of open to it, and there's definitely a lot of interest around it. Like, a lot of the guys ask about it. Yeah, I think, like, it'll take time. But that's more, I think a lot of people would love to, but it's just being able to have an environment where that's kind of embraced, which, you know, our team's doing, and it's very new. So it's breaking, like, a very long tradition of what racing looks like, which takes time. But yeah, I think it'll happen.
So I said to Lockie, like, you must be really stoked to be able to be doing this kind of racing alongside your normal career. And I absolutely loved the answer he gave, because in his own little modest way, he kind of said, well, actually, I've worked really hard to get here.
Yeah, it's a really great opportunity. I'm super grateful to have it. It's like, I mean, it was also like a process to get to this point. It's not like it just sprung up out of the blue and, like, I was like, oh, amazing, this opportunity came up, like, just what I wanted. I just manifested this. There was, like, I guess more to it than that. But I'm really grateful to, you know, have, like, backing of like, a team like EF, because, you know, it's opened a lot of doors for me. And the reality is to be able to juggle these events and race World Tour events, it doesn't exist for anyone else outside of our team. So, like, it's a pretty incredible opportunity, I guess.
That was Lachlan Morton. It was absolutely amazing to be able to hear from him firsthand exactly how he found that experience. So if you're feeling inspired to take a bit more of a look at the GB Giro route, there's actually no less than 4 official collections on Komoot. We decided to split it up because it was so long. So there's 4 collections covering the southwest of England, Wales, the north of England and Scotland. So you can go and ride the whole route if you want, or you can split it up. It's probably a bit more achievable for 99% of us, whether it's like a couple of days at a time, or you just want to do one day on the part that's most local to you. And then we've also got the opportunity, if you haven't used Komoot before, to get a free region bundle. So all you have to do is go to komoot.com/G, and then you enter the code UNPAVED. That's all in capitals. We'll put all the instructions in the show notes down below, so you can just go through there. It's really easy. And then, of course, there's this episode's route. So at the start of the episode, you heard us riding up the hill into the woods to our bivvy spot for the night. And then in the morning, we sort of dusted some of the frost off of our tyres and wore literally every layer I think we each had. And down to the Handlebar Cafe, which was right in the centre of, like, beautiful historic Oxford. And it was really good, actually, because first thing in the morning, there aren't that many people around and you can sort of weave in through the streets. So I got a coffee and then asked Miles about what the ride was looking like for the day.
Well, it's currently going through a little bit of a revision. We are running a little bit behind schedule. So I think we're going to take an axe to the original plan and then, freestyle it a little bit. But it'll be fun.
What should we expect from today?
I think we'll cruise through Oxford and take in some historic sights, go up by the Thames, through some woods, a bit of nice, easy, non-muddy gravel, let's hope.
So Mark from Bike Zone Oxford, who was our wonderful local guide for the day, had reworked the route, but in addition to us being a little bit late, we also ran into another unexpected obstacle.
Yeah, it wasn't like this the other day.
We're riding a route that I typically do after work, but I've not done it in a while, and it's a bit flooded. So yeah, we're gonna have to either build a bridge or just chance our luck basically with a bit of a pond.
So we went through this little gate into this field, and the water was so high all the way around the gate, but there was just this sort of jetty, like these wooden planks extending into this water. So what would have been the path was now this long diving board, essentially into a bog. And Mark, I think, was the only one feeling brave or confident or maybe stupid enough to actually consider riding straight off of it, straight into the bog and across the field.
right, you're going first.
I'm going first.
So you're going to ride off the end.
I wouldn't ride off the end of that. You're just sinking to mud, aren't you?
I will put my front wheel in first. Yeah. If it feels all right, I'll get a small run up and just ride through.
Right, get your cameras out.
Let's do it.
After you then.
What could go wrong?
What could go wrong?
I think we can be quite proud of the group there.
Yeah.
I was really expecting somebody to be lying in ice.
It's quite a shame, really. Can't make a big splash. Top marks to Mark for riding through it.
100%.
That takes a
bit of courage.
And then as we carried on across this field, it was just either beautiful lush grass or this really deep moat like pond reflecting the blue sky, and then horses just sort of scattered about, and this bunker or bus stop kind of structure right in the middle.
Ooh, all that Hotel Venice style.
Yeah. You need a gondola to get in and out. Yeah. It'd be lovely.
I'm not gonna lie, I was pretty miffed that producer Tom missed what I thought was one of the best parts of the day.
Oh. Yeah, I was pretty devastated as well. We were just riding across what looked like a grass flat field. So I thought I'd turn the microphone off for a little while. And then about 5 seconds later, I just heard this huge shriek from Philippa.
Talk me through what happened back there, Phil.
I wasn't concentrating on the river I was cycling through. So I ended up with my foot ankle deep in mud and water.
And ice.
Yeah, so I now have one very, very cold left foot. Oh. But I've got spare socks!
Hey!
Whee. Pretty nice, all this water. They're like these, like the playgrounds this morning, and the goalposts. These weird, reflective, like surreal landscapes.
Yeah.
That you'd never normally see them like that.
Especially when the sun is as bright as it is today.
Yeah, and it's so still.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. I was finding that horse reflection in the water just quite surreal.
Yeah, yeah. With the bunker floating in the water.
Yeah.
That's the sort of photo you'd see in a gallery, and it'd be like surreal, like bunker and horse.
Yeah.
Next to lake.
So I was riding along with Philippa at this point, and it was mid-Jan when we were recording this, and it wasn't long since I'd been on my Christmas break. Whilst on Instagram, I was watching her on a cargo bike riding from Edinburgh all the way to Copenhagen with the Adventure Syndicate. So I asked her a bit about how that was and how freezing it looked.
Tell me what you did.
Myself and three other women, Jenny Graham, Lee Craigie and Alice Lemkis, cycled two cargo bikes between us from Edinburgh to Copenhagen between Boxing Day and New Year's. So about 1,000 kilometres riding and then cargoing.
It looked so cold cargo.
Yeah, it was freezing. That was probably one of the hardest things to deal with, was the sort of cold and discomfort of being the passenger. Whereas actually the riding, it was pretty much pan flat once we hit the continent. So actually the weight doesn't really affect you so much. But after an hour sitting on the front of a bike in sort of sub-zero temperatures, even if you're like coated in four layers of down, you still get pretty chilly.
How did you hatch the plan?
Lee and Jenny had... Lee had actually got out to Copenhagen to do a podcast about like the craft of making these wooden bikes with this company in Copenhagen. And they also make a cargo bike. So they sort of came up with this idea of, why don't we do this potentially impossible thing? We don't even know how long can you ride a load that big, and is it feasible to do it in that time frame, to sort of raise awareness of the climate crisis. And also just that's kind of dead time between Christmas and New Year's, when all you're really doing is like eating and sitting on the sofa and just consuming, to go and do something in a particularly sort of tough time of year, just to sort of hopefully, you know, maybe inspire some people to get off the sofa and get outside and be like, oh, well, if they can do that. But we had no idea if it was possible. We realised probably on like day two, we were like, we might just do this. But we hadn't had very much time beforehand to... me and Jenny had ridden together for like a day on a cargo bike.
Was your handling quite difficult at first?
Yeah.
Quite hard to ride, aren't it?
Yeah, yeah. It definitely took a lot of getting used to. And, there's a fair amount of footage of the actual like spills, which happened quite frequently. Depending on which bike you were on. We had two different bikes. The Bullet, which is sort of steady and stable and a bit heavier. And then the Omnium, which is this slightly like nippier, lighter, cruisier thing, but you're on a much higher platform, so that was less stable. But it was surprising how quickly you built up confidence in your own riding and your partner's. So we would, you know, like bombing along at 50 kilometres an hour, it was probably partly just you're sort of cold and tired and on the front, so you're like, oh fuck it, if I came off, then you know. Is that the worst that happened? Although actually there was quite a big crash, and I think we actually reflected afterwards on how dangerous it could have been. But you know, we're already cooking up plans for next year, so wasn't that bad.
What was it like when you arrived in Copenhagen?
Yeah, it was pretty amazing. The run-in was incredible because between Christmas and New Year's is the only time in Denmark you're allowed to buy fireworks. So it's like just lawless, like setting off a firework. So for the sort of last 40k, it felt like every 2-3 seconds there was a firework somewhere going off. So it was incredible, and the streets were just completely deserted until you hit Copenhagen, and then there were people setting them off in the streets, and you were going through like clouds of smoke, and you got into the centre, and someone had told us it's a bit like a fun war zone, and it felt like that. There was just like the biggest booms going off everywhere, like fireworks metres away from you, just like rockets being shot into the air. So it was like mad. And then we got in at just before 11, and then hit the pub, and then started to fall asleep in the pub around 2, got kebabs, and then went home.
So after a few mucky bridleways and byways and then this little section through the woods, we sort of turned a corner, and then all of a sudden we were in this amazing sand bowl, and it was this nature reserve that had these little single track trails which you had to like really power up to try and get up these banks. And then they were quite sketchy on the descent as well because they were so steep and sandy. And then little sand pits where you could try and do a figure of 8 and inevitably fail. I ended up on my knees on that one. And the sun actually came out whilst we were there, which was really very well received in January, especially as it was so cold. So we stopped there a little while and had a chat about the route.
We've gone probably no more than 5 miles from the town centre at any point, so it's all accessible from the town centre or after your day job.
So we had a slightly different route in mind at the start of today, which we've decided not to do. Can you tell us a little bit more about that route?
That's another sort of classic after work route, with more gravel and orientated sections, maybe a bit less mud, maybe a bit less flooding, but you can't really avoid it this time of year, no matter where you go, really. So damage limitation.
Plenty of water today still.
But it's made for a fun, interesting ride. Like, it's just kind of made it a bit more exciting, a bit more unpredictable. And yeah, everything going perfectly doesn't necessarily mean a better ride. So yeah, you can take a risk sometimes and just go with the flow. Go down that track you don't know, or cross that flooded section of mucky field that you probably shouldn't go through, but it's fun.
Or
in the
send
end.
It off the end of this like wooden pier like you did.
Yeah, you could do
and not go over the bars, which was very impressive.
taking a hit for the team.
So we were coming towards the end of the ride now, just like we're coming to the end of this podcast. So we thought it would be a really good chance to wrap up talking to Tom, Philippa and Miles about their personal experiences on GB Giro.
It honestly felt like one of the best, like well thought through routes. There was none of it that, and I didn't do any of the routes, so I'm not like prey. I'm like, well done me. I knew none of the routes. It was all a surprise. And I think that's because of how it had been pieced together, borrowing bits from other bits that people had already recce'd. It did feel like it was done by people who knew their areas really well. And then you've linked up this route the length of the country, whereas some of the other events that I'd done, like I did the Isley Divide, and some of that felt a bit more like just, you know, doing like gratuitous hiker bike next to a road just to get it in there. And it's like, whereas, you know, going off the back of what is it called, Great Dunfell, that was a necessity to make that a proper link, rather than having to, if you'd come back down the same way, then that's just a climb for the sake of a climb. But it's because you were connecting these dots and sort of moving in a constant direction. And I think that's a very satisfying thing to do. And hopefully, you imagine like most of the route, anyone is within probably about 100 miles of the route, or if not less. And I'm sort of 15 miles from Bristol. So I've been meaning to go back and do, you know, head south from Bristol along the route and do the bit going north into Wales again, in just a slightly more chilled way, and actually take it all in a lot more. And I think it's nice that people can, they can go and do that.
Absolutely. Like, I think it's worth mentioning the fact that it is now an established route as GB Divide rather than the event GB Giro, which is published online by Miles, several different places, and you can just go and tour it if you want. Yeah. It's an incredible route, not only to push yourself on, but also to tour, whether you want to do that in one go over weeks and weeks, or whether you want to split it into chunks and maybe do a section every year. Together. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's really cool to have that resource online and available to everyone.
Mm. Yeah, and as a start location, I mean, it was a beautiful morning, and yeah, there's something very cool about, you've just got 180 degrees of ocean one way, and then you just land all the way up to the top, and then hitting it at the end. It's very satisfying experience, and yeah, so a pretty epic place to start a race. Land's End.
Oh. I almost want to try it.
You should. You're capable of more than you think you are.
I think I find it really fascinating about what you talk, that, you know, 99% of the people doing this are just average people.
Yeah.
And they go home and they've got jobs, full-time jobs, families, children to look after, and how they fit in preparing and training and getting their heads around something that's such a massive scale. How do you think people do it? How do you do it?
Well, I guess when I did the first one, I'd quit my full-time job, so it meant that I was more in control of my own time, being self-employed, so I guess that helps. And I always actually do feel quite ill-prepared at the start, and I just, as soon as we set off, I like realise that something is not where it should be. I'm like, oh, why did I just not think about this yesterday? So it is really hard, and it does take planning. And actually, the most stressful part is definitely the prep. And once you actually get going, you know, you can sort most things on the road. But yeah, I think if it's something you want to do, just try and start planning early, mitigating all the potential pitfalls. But I think anyone would be surprised at what actually they're capable of doing versus what they think they can do. Because all my experience has been that, you tend to be able to do a lot more than what you think is possible. So if you're even thinking about it, you can almost definitely do it. Or at least start.
I think that would be a really interesting one for Tom, actually. In terms of how you prepare, for especially riding five events, how you prepare and train for these sorts of things when you live in London, in such a big city.
Yeah.
I mean, are you constantly on the indoor trainer, or are you getting out and about?
Yeah, luckily for me, I've discovered I really like doing indoor cycling. When a lot of people hate it, so it's a completely personal choice. And if you're not into doing that, then it makes it a lot harder. It also, in London, it depends a lot on where you live in London, because basically you can't really be going through the middle of London to try and get to your training rides because it just takes so long to do that. So you're limited to wherever your closest sort of exit point is from the city. Mine is northeast into Essex, which is basically flat. So it's not that useful if you're doing these events that have got loads and loads of climbing. Yeah, exactly. So I found myself doing like sort of 45 minute or hour and a half sessions at a place called H2 in Soho, which it's not like a spin class, it's more like set up as a kind of properly thought through constructed training plan for actual cyclists. And you go in there, and the great thing is that means you can build that in around your day, and it's very practical to squeeze that in. You know, I would go before work, probably do like an hour session, have a shower, go into work, and you feel amazing because you've just done this really intensive session, and because you're not doing things like stopping at traffic lights. You know, there's a lot less time that you might be wasting, faff time, you know. It's just this as intense and kind of direct as
perfect training you can get for ultras, no faffing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's kind of what I found myself doing a lot of, and it seems to have worked. But I think as well, just with endurance, it's really about building up a kind of base of endurance over time. And when you do things like, if you go on like Audaxes and Sportives, you'll always get the old boys cruising past you, and they're in their like 60s, and because they've been doing it for so many years, they've just gradually built up this amazing sort of endurance base. And I think a lot of it is to do with that. So it's probably a lot harder when you're coming into it, because you have to go through a few of these events and races to start with to build up that base. I think there's only so much you can do through training, and that's why it almost became, I wasn't really doing much training last year after a while, because doing the races was effectively like training for the next ones.
So in the run up to your first ultra event, or think back to the time you did your first transcontinental, how long were you thinking and preparing about the race beforehand?
It's pretty much a year long kind of lead into it, I think. You have to almost start training before you know whether you've got a place on it, because I think generally speaking you'll find out in the new year or around about Christmas time or the new year, so that gives you like about 6 months to get your training done. But for the first one, because I was so scared of doing it, I was very, very like conscientious about training, and probably did more than, I certainly did more on the first one than either of the other two, because it's the unknown, you don't know quite how you're going to do. So I definitely started pretty much the summer before, you know, and I had a set amount, I can't remember how much it was now, but I had a set amount of kilometres that I set myself to ride every week, and just through like commuting and then topping that up at the weekends with rides. So I would have got through a lot of distance before even getting to the start. And that's the physical bit, but then there's also a huge amount of time that you have to invest in route planning. And if it's your first one, there's also a lot of research going into like what kit you need to buy. You know, there's endless reports online from other people that have done these things before, where you can really start to get into the minutiae of, you know, tyre selection and you know, different ways to set up your luggage. And there's, you know, it's like anything, that when you start getting into it, you just get deeper and deeper into the forums of like discussions on tire widths and pressures and things like that. So
did you find anyone as a mentor or somebody that you knew that had done the race before that you could ask a lot of these questions to, or was it a lot more online research?
I think for the first one, because I hadn't really met anybody else that was doing this kind of stuff, it was pretty much a solo mission of like just trying to research it all. But as you go on and you do more of the events, because it's such a small community, you start to meet lots of other people that do it, and then you've got like this nice little network that you can go and find out all this information and see what other people are doing and share ideas. So it's kind of it gets a bit more it gets easier and it gets more fun the more you get become part of the scene, I suppose.
Did you pick up anything during your three times on the Transcontinental that you could pass on in terms of tricks or hacks or things that you've changed to make it easier for yourself?
Yeah, I mean, broadly speaking, you learn so much every time you do any race, and you will make multiple mistakes on each one. And the first TCR I did was just an absolute horror show. Like everything went wrong, but because of that, you know, your learning curve is so steep. You know, I would have come out of that having learnt like probably 80% of the stuff that I now know about doing these things. Yeah, I got hit by a deer, which totally destroyed my front wheel. And then the knock-on effect of that was that I kept getting punctures because the wheel was kind of rebuilt badly, and it wasn't even round for about 1,000 kilometres of the race. It was like riding a horse. I finally got that sorted out in like something like Bosnia or something, and then it felt like having a new bike, and it was like effortless to ride. But yeah, all sorts of stuff like that happened. But yeah, things that you learn from that are just you know, always making sure you've got enough spare parts. Like my race ended because my rear mech came off, and I didn't have a mech hanger, and I didn't really have the skills to sort of botch your repair, and I ran out of time. So then you make sure that you take a spare hanger, and you know, learn a bit more kind of bike maintenance to make sure you can be self-sufficient in those situations. So yeah, I think I mean you could go into the specifics of this for like hours, but generally speaking, it's experiences that teach you the most. You know, you can go and read as much as you want on forums and from other people's experiences until you've actually learnt them the hard way and suffered the actual consequences and found out what that means in reality. You don't really learn those lessons seriously, I don't think. But now, you know, there's probably lots of stuff that I do without thinking about it that has come from going through those experiences.
So that's it for episode 3, but we've got loads more from this trip coming to you next week.
Yeah, I was listening back through the material, and this episode, as you've heard, was focused on the Racing Collective and GB Duro, and it felt like it would be a good thing for you guys listening to it to hear all about that in this episode and to hold back a little bit of the conversation that we had with Philippa and Tom. We spoke to them up by the campfire when we were staying out in the woods, and we're going to bring you that conversation in part 2 next week.
Yeah, it was just one of those evenings where you lost track of time because it was so fascinating hearing these stories. And yeah, I hope they'll be as inspiring for other people as they have been to me personally.
So thanks for listening, and don't forget that you can ride today's route by going to our Komoot profile, where you can find all of the routes from every episode of Unpaved.
Yeah, and when you do go and have your coffee in Handlebar Cafe, pop in to Bike Zone and say hi to Mark, because he's got loads of other routes up his sleeve. He's a real local aficionado of off-road riding. And this is your last chance to enter our giveaway for 2 tickets for Brother in the Wild, which is essentially like a mini festival all about bikepacking in the Purbex in Dorset. We're going to be doing the draw at noon on Friday the 6th of March, and all you have to do is sign up to our newsletter to enter.